Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. On today's show, we'll hear a radio adaptation of an essay written for the Reimagining Society project hosted by Z Communications. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Bay State Banner has been reporting stories for the black community in Boston for 44 years, but the Free Weekly had to stop publishing this month due to financial woes. The Banner has a reputation of holding city officials accountable to the public on a variety of issues, including development in poor neighborhoods and hiring more black police officers. Recognizing the value of a black-owned community newspaper, Harvard University law professor Charles J. Ogletree is putting together a group of investors to try to keep the paper alive. And Boston Mayor Thomas Menino offered the Banner a $200,000 loan that would be funded by a private nonprofit, Boston Local Development Corp. Banner publisher Mel Miller has accepted the offer. Victor Picard, senior research fellow at Free Press, cautions that the plight of the Bay State Banner is another example of a systemic crisis facing journalism around the country.
The Banner's case suggests it's more evidence for how advertising no longer adequately supports the kind of journalism that our democracy requires, and that we're dealing with the effects of a kind of market failure here. So when we're talking about this being a systemic crisis, we have to understand that this is a problem for public policy if the market is not supporting journalism.
One-time bailouts aren't going to be helpful to this systemic failure in the long run. Picard instead suggests changing tax laws to allow struggling news organizations to become low-profit, limited-liability companies, or L3Cs.
L3C is a hybrid that would allow both private investments and charitable contributions while mandating public service to local communities. It would be an ideal approach to struggling news organizations, especially small newspapers.
Some have criticized Menino's loan offer, saying the money could compromise the Bay State Banner's impartiality during an election year. Picard says we should always be watchful when large amounts of money are given to media organizations. But
we should also point out that the influence from advertisers that fund commercial media and the corporations that often own these commercial media is no less problematic. And so really a better scenario would be to have more permanent funds devoted to public media that are beyond the reach of politics as well as market pressures.
In 2007, Verizon approached the Massachusetts legislature with a mission: to change the laws that govern how cable companies negotiate with cities and towns to offer video services. Similar so-called statewide franchising laws were enacted in more than a dozen states over the past few years as telephone companies looked for ways to break into the pay TV business. But after Massachusetts Public Access Television activists turned out hundreds of concerned residents at a public hearing on the bill, the legislation never came to a vote. 2 years later, Verizon is back with a new bill, and public access advocates are once again turning up the heat. A public hearing was held at the State House on July 22nd. Colin Rhinesmith of Cambridge Community Television, an award-winning public access center, attended the hearing. Rhinesmith explains Verizon's new bill would change the laws over local franchise negotiations in ways that could harm community media.
The current system that's been in place for the past 30 years works, and we believe that this legislation could have a real negative impact on cities and towns across Massachusetts. And in particular, we're most concerned about the threat to the cable franchising process, which would limit the negotiation period to 90 days, which would essentially make meaningful negotiations impossible.
Many of the people who testified at this week's public hearing said the negotiation process was lengthy and complex, even for cities and towns with significant resources. 90 days, they said, would not provide municipalities enough time to truly assess the needs of their communities. They were particularly concerned for smaller rural towns, which rely on volunteers to negotiate these contracts.
I think what we saw yesterday at the hearing was overwhelming opposition to the legislation. There was a packed house with public access supporters, local officials from across the state. There was a single message that this bill is bad for local communities.
To find out more about Cambridge Community Television and the Massachusetts bill, go to cctvcambridge.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
When Reverend Edward Pinckney was freed from prison last week, some hailed the Michigan Appeals Court decision as a great victory. Only in a society in which racial insult and depression is general, an everyday fact of life, would Reverend Pinckney's release after spending nearly a year in 8 different Michigan prisons be considered a triumph of justice. Rather, it is only a partial rollback of a series of horrendous wrongs. Reverend Pinckney became what the American Civil Liberties Union described as the first man in modern times to be imprisoned for predicting what God might do. Actually, I thought that much of the job description of a minister consisted of predicting and anticipating God's point of view. Specifically, Pinckney wrote an article for a Chicago newspaper that predicted the judge who convicted him of vote fraud would be cursed by God. On top of that, Pinckney expressed the opinion that the judge was racist, dumb, and corrupt. For this exercise of his freedom of speech and religion, Reverend Pinckney's probation on the voter fraud conviction was revoked. He now faced 3 to 10 years hard time. So began his odyssey from one Michigan prison to another, as state authorities tried to bury the Baptist minister deeper and deeper in their dungeons. A national legal and political campaign ultimately culminated in Pinckney's release. But, as is usually the case in confrontations between a black man and a racist state apparatus, the damage inflicted can never be fully or even substantially repaired. The first item on the loss side of the ledger is the fact that Pinckney's hometown, predominantly black Benton Harbor, Michigan, has been deprived of this black leader and preacher's services for well over a year. The white power structure, against which Reverend Pinckney tirelessly organized, succeeded in getting him off the streets for a significant period of time. The appeals court that freed Reverend Pinckney refused to order a new trial on the original voter fraud charges. The court acknowledged that Berrien County committed 13 separate errors in the case, but declared these errors were harmless and would not have altered the verdict. Harmless errors. Power always holds itself harmless while committing great crimes. One of the crimes Reverend Pinckney fought so hard to resist is gentrification. Benton Harbor's lakeside location makes it a prime real estate attraction to the wealthy. When the leader of the anti-gentrification movement is forced to spend all his energy and time avoiding doing hard prison time, the gentrifiers win. And so, the net effect of Reverend Pinckney's release last week is a mitigation of loss rather than a victory. As the great Amilcar Cabral advised, tell no lies and claim no easy victories. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature a radio adaptation of an essay written for the Reimagining Society Project, hosted by Z Communications. The essay, which I wrote, is entitled The Montesi Maneuver Extended, A Strategy Toward a Participatory Economy, and published online on July 13, 2009. You could select any topic that subsumes anything that might be called left activism: the environment, war and militarism, labor rights, energy, education, media, electoral politics, food and drink, banking and finance, just to name a few broad topics. Chances are very good that one or more corporations hold a considerable, often overwhelming, degree of control and influence. The record documenting corporate influence and malfeasance is vast, and the efforts to combat corporations have been growing and gaining in influence. But one can argue that their effectiveness has thus far been insufficient, and what is unquestionable is that those efforts must improve and escalate dramatically in order to secure a better future, or any future for that matter. How to do so is the topic of this presentation, and this paper outlines one possible strategy, which involves the structure of corporations, the markets in which they thrive, the resulting irony of the structure of corporations, the relation of that to participatory economics, and how that is a proposed key to increasing an anti-corporate opposition. I have presented some of the ideas in what follows online in ZNet and in other fora, and so some of what follows may not be new to some. For the purposes of this essay, we define a corporation to be an economic entity legally defined with the goal of ever-increasing levels of short-term profit for its shareholders at the expense of everything else. That includes present considerations for human health, labor rights, and our shared natural environment, plus considerations pertaining to future generations from whom we are presently borrowing from them our time on this planet. To be sure, not all entities called corporations, either now or in the past, were structured like this or obeyed this mandate. But our focus is those corporations which do pose a tremendous threat and which do understandably follow this mandate. We hone our definition accordingly. In the course of striving for victories toward this aim, corporations have won limited liability status, which insulates them from increasing public costs which might affect their private profits. Worse, in the wake of the 1886 Santa Clara ruling in the U.S. Supreme Court, American corporations gained the status of persons, so that corporations can equate money as free speech in political elections and in decisions on coverage by corporate media outlets. Laws toward freedom of speech thus, in a perverted irony, become just another weapon in their arsenal. But why would corporations want to gain such advantages? It seems almost silly to ask, but I think that there is a non-obvious structural economic rationale for pursuit of these advantages. The rationale I'm referring to is that corporations operate within a larger economic context, that of markets. For our purposes, I emphasize the competitive nature of markets in this definition of markets, an institution of buyers and sellers where buyers and sellers are pitted against one another in antagonistic roles. Granted, it is possible to gain money and power in markets without antagonism between parties, but the roles of buyers and sellers are themselves by definition antagonistic, and it is clearly also possible and common to succeed in markets to treat them as cruel wrestling matches where the strongest survive. Since winning is obviously better than losing, and since one can gain at the expense of others in the market, it thus makes sense to behave in a brutish fashion in a market, to always behave in a way that would take advantage of others. That is, it's rational to become a monster or exhibit behavior like that of a monster in a market. One rational response in this context is to fight fire with fire and become a monster in response. Then it becomes a matter of monsters fighting other monsters, and the bigger the monster, the better the chance to win. Nietzsche is attributed with the following pertinent quote: "Battle not with monsters, lest ye become a monster." And that's where corporations come in. A corporation can be thought of as the equivalent of a monster in a market economy, an economic entity solely dedicated to its own sole purpose at the expense of everything else. In a competitive context, it's where it's either you or someone else fighting for something only one of you can get. It makes sense to develop into a monster to win those competitions. This also explains why markets tend to consolidate. Amid competition, participants tend to be eliminated through buyout or attrition or both, so that there are fewer players in the game and markets as a result wind up concentrating. In this context, markets, long touted as an alternative to command economies, actually promote command economies, though those command economies are internal to corporations. Since it's advantageous for an entity to behave like a monster within a market economy, it follows to keep that monstrous behavior within that entity's internal operations and internal structure. Thus, the internal structure of a corporation would tend to become a dictatorship. Power is concentrated in the relative few, a hierarchy of power is developed, orders come from the top down, obedience comes from the bottom up, and those within the structure are left with the only options to obey or leave. One can take the list in Robin Hanel's book, Economic Justice and Democracy, of theoretical complaints leveraged against command economies that emerge from the state. 1. There's a dictatorial down-go-orders-up-come-obedience dynamic. 2. Social effects of consumption and production are never determined. 3. Conceptual workers monopolize technical information. 4. Managers and workers constantly fight each other. And also leverage that list in a Jacques fashion against corporations, precisely because corporations are also command economies. The market-advocating economist Milton Friedman, who spent his career criticizing command economies and touting markets as superior to command economies, may have ultimately become the biggest and most unwitting supporter of command economies. The only difference being those command economies did not emerge from the state. It stands to reason that command planning and markets are two sides of the same coin. So, to follow a metaphor inspired by evolutionary biology, corporations emerge as the resulting dominant life form in this economic niche of markets. Thus, it would stand to reason that if the market niche is replaced with something else where the corporate life form is at a disadvantage, the corporate life form might die off or be replaced. But what economic niche do you put in its place instead to address economic needs? And how do you know that its replacement won't also have horrible consequences? The replacement, I believe, is that of participatory economics. The economic model of par econ, participatory economics, has widened in influence and attention in recent years, and it has gained increasing prominence as a model to promote solidarity, efficiency, equity, diversity, self-management, and environmental protection. I also submit that par econ can be the economic mechanism to abolish corporations, and can be the strategic linchpin for anti-corporate movements to leverage around. Clearly, a participatory economy is antithetical to the way a corporation functions. Corporations bear job hierarchies, where participatory economics requires jobs balanced for desirability and empowerment. Corporations pay unfair wages and make decisions that, often negatively, affect those outside of the corporation, with little say in those decisions. Par econ, by definition, pays more fairly and strives to provide more fair decision-making power to its participants. Corporations rely on an external market to gain strength and prominence on a macro scale and to maintain its hierarchical control and dominance on a micro scale. Par econ does not use markets, but rather participatory planning for the shared goal of eliminating excess demand. Some who oppose corporate actions may argue that they don't oppose what corporations are, they oppose what corporations do. Such a response avoids the issue. Corporate actions and corporate structures are directly linked. The reason corporations are structured as they are is so they can act as they do, and markets serve as a key economic context and thus a key economic reason for corporate behavior. So, structurally speaking, those who oppose corporate actions have reason to oppose corporations, and those who oppose corporations have reason to oppose markets. And an opposition to markets requires a response to the matter of what economic model we use instead, which we believe to be participatory economics. What follows next might be considered to be controversial by some, obvious by others, but seldom formally stated aloud or in print. To wit, those individuals and organizations who advocate against corporations or corporate actions should include market abolitionism and advocacy of participatory economics as a plank in their respective anti-corporate platforms and in the operation insofar as possible of their own organizations. Easier said than done. In fact, it's quite likely that convincing the left to do this would be far harder than convincing the general population. Whether it be on the left, the general population, or some combination of the two, those of us who count ourselves as par econ advocates should act to widen par econ awareness and implementation among anti-corporate activists. The rewards are immense, the challenge more so, but there's a potential here to unify and strengthen the anti-corporate movements as few things ever have. In effect, I'm proposing a merger of sorts of anti-corporate efforts and those aligned with participatory economics. I call this the Montesi Maneuver, named for a family of clergy in American graphic novels in the 1980s who found a similar merger against another alignment of destructive forces. In recent presentations I've given about participatory economics, I have mentioned three categories of actions that can be pursued to help us lead us closer to a participatory economy. 1. Media and outreach efforts to widen awareness. 2. Challenging current non-PariCon structures. 3. Building and sustaining new PariCon-ish structures in our current economic climate. I would still advocate these three categories of action for this paper as well, but I'll now discuss these categories in light of the Montesi maneuver. On media and outreach. This can mean media creation of some sort, be it a flyer, an article, a book, a novel, an in-person speech, a radio interview, a short film, a video, a web page, a website, a blog, a song, an album, and so forth. The PariCon movement has certainly used this to help to promote the model and widen awareness. But it's time for the movement to talk and develop ideas about how the model interacts with other parts of the economy and other social visions. In Chicago, I was part of a presentation that discussed PariCon and its connection to finance. The link is available online at www.chicagoparecon.org. But the time has come for PariCon and Media 102, where we connect the model more widely, the Montesi maneuver being one realm, critique those connections, and expand the intellectual terrain further. It also means defending and expanding those media outlets where media and discussion of issues can actually happen. This is the terrain of media policy, those laws and policies which affect media. There has been some progress on this realm in the United States. Increased numbers of non-commercial, low-power, and educational FM radio outlets, with hopefully more on the way, blocks of repeated attempts to dramatically escalate media concentration, which is now playing a role in the newspaper and TV industries, certainly in the U.S., and maintaining the principle of non-discrimination by internet service providers, also called net neutrality. There have also been defeats, losing the rights of some states to establish municipal internet networks, and losing some public access channels in the wake of lobbyist-pushed state video franchises, among the most notable. This should be a priority for left activists, not just to help to win a participatory economy, but to help buttress all activist efforts. On challenging current structures. The Montesi maneuver will face considerable opposition in the United States, ironically enough, from those groups and campaigns that have worked on anti-corporate campaigns. The reason, I submit, is that many U.S. nonprofit organizations that have worked on campaigns against corporations are themselves structured as corporations. In the United States, nonprofit organizations to achieve tax-exempt status are required by law to establish a hierarchical corporate structure, what is referred to as a 501c3. Grant money and large-scale donations fuel nonprofit hierarchical organizations in the nonprofit sector that abide by this corporate structure. And obviously any structural deviation from that, like that involving PariCon-ish norms, put that income stream at risk. There are some 501c3s that actually do follow PariCon-ish norms and institutions, for example, Z Communications. But overwhelmingly, this is a terrain where we can expect a fight, to put it lightly. But we can also make some progress even here, to mention one personal example. I've been involved with the economic equity group of the Chicago chapter of the National Organization for Women, or NOW. Now, NOW is set up with a corporate structure. But as a member of the economic equity group in the Chicago NOW, I've used my membership in the group to talk about participatory economics. Recently, the group has taken to discussing the model, particularly in the connections of PariCon to women's economic equity, creating our own media on the topic, and building the basis for future action, including extending connections to other groups. The hope is that once we have our foot in the door, we can extend the critique to the Montesi maneuver. And key among the tasks that lay before us is to stop making positive appeals to markets, whether it's public interest lobbyists speaking highly of markets in public pronouncements to more, quote, radical, unquote, economic models, which some refer to as, quote, market socialism, unquote, and try to shoehorn markets to behave more humanely. Indeed, provisions can be put in place to mitigate the negative effects of markets, just as we see in present-day efforts to oppose corporations. But corporations have a powerful incentive to fight back, and they also have the muscle, thanks to the antagonistic predilection of markets, to win a lot of their fights. As a result, proposals which incorporate markets in their vision, I think, are inevitably flawed, since markets serve as spawning grounds and as a source of strength for corporations. On building structures. If we think we have a better model, we should show its merits in everyday life. We should implement it in our own lives and in institutions and in ways that we think that are helpful. The book Real Utopia mentions some examples, but there's tremendous potential beyond the choir. Let me quote an email from one PariCon advocate who was also involved in some of the early development of Wikipedia and referred to some principles of anarchism in Wikipedia's structure. The email, quote, begins, "Wikipedia was a wonderful example of anarchy. But we agreed at some point that we were, one, building an encyclopedia, and two, borrowing some principles from anarchism in order to facilitate that. I bothered in Wikipedia because it was accomplishing something, the world's greatest resource of information, free for all to use, not because it was anarchistic. The spread of Parikanish principles will come from people adopting them into tasks with other purposes. If Wikipedia had been about proving an anarchist model for information aggregation, it would have fallen flat on its face on the millions of arguments that arise." Unquote. Many have suggested establishing Parikanish businesses, but many of those businesses have had one foot in activism, publishing, journalism, bookselling. Along the lines of something like Wikipedia, I wonder if a different approach might be to start businesses in markets outside the traditional left professions, then use some of the profits to help fund left activist efforts and campaigns to help people. We are seeing some examples, with Parikan-inspired businesses in areas as diverse and unlikely as symphony music, computer programming, extreme travel, and dentistry. More activities, in realms that can include sports, law, medicine, engineering, and consulting, are ripe for new Parikan-related exploration, but we can't be afraid of foreclosing our options. Indeed, some of the most important activist work now might be in the realm of imagination, for it's there that we spur the new actions that we need to change the world. I'll conclude this presentation with a word about what to do to the inevitable attacks that this movement will face when it continues to grow and build and expand. If current trends continue and current activism proceeds, we can expect this movement to enter the realm of increased public awareness and attacks from those who want to strangle it in the crib. What form might those attacks take? One is that of slander, smearing the name of Parikan through the mud as was done with words like socialist or liberal, which then makes it convenient for verbal attacks. We see a current example of this in the current battle for domestic healthcare reform in the United States. The best available option for the public, and which growing numbers of activists have been advocating, is that of a single-payer system much like that in most of the industrialized world. But on those rare occasions when single-payer is mentioned in the major corporate media, it is always attacked, and the attacks take the form of using terms which are deemed dismissive or slanderous, like socialist, which then ends the discussion. I think we can expect Parikan to follow this pattern, where the name will be snarled at and attacked. One tactic we can use to respond to this would be to have at the ready new terms to describe the institutions so that if we have to, we can abandon one term, but we can continue our work so that we're not groping for very long to find a new term to describe the institutions we're advocating for. We can also one day expect a more concerted physical attack upon Parikan institutions by dominant sectors, reminiscent of the COINTELPRO attacks upon American activists in the 1960s. If so, then slander would seem tame by comparison, and more drastic defenses might be in order. Some of those defenses might take the form of the kind of affinity groups and organizing efforts that left activist groups in recent years have used to elude future interlopers, though how that might manifest itself when building a new entire economy is a question that I leave open for the time being. That was a radio adaptation of The Montesi Maneuver Extended, A Strategy Toward a Participatory Economy, published online on July 13, 2009. The Reimagining Society Project, which strives to assemble some of the world's leading thinkers on ideas for a future society, is linked at the website of Z Communications, online at www.zcommunications.org. That's the letter Z, communications.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.